Good morning and welcome to this January 22nd, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. And you can always find Barbara at Pen on Fire at penonfire.com. You can find me at Marie Stone, M-A-R-R-I-E Stone.com. And there you can figure out how to write to us if you have any thoughts, any suggestions, any feedback you'd like to, you can always reach out and our contact information is up there. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning with this chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. You have asked us for more small press authors. We are doing that this morning. You have asked us for more short story authors. We're also doing that this morning. You've asked for a little genre bending and we're doing that too. So we take your feedback to heart, and we try to bring you exactly what you're looking for. This morning, I am on with Julie Zuckerman and her novel, The Book of Jeremiah. And in the second half, I'm on with Anna Lee Nuitz. The Future of Another Timeline is their book. Julie Zuckerman's fiction and nonfiction have appeared in a variety of publications, including the SFWP Quarterly, The MacGuffin, Salt Hill, Sixfold, The Coil, Ellipses, Crab Orchard Review, and others. The Book of Jeremiah is her debut story collection, a novel in stories. It is published by Press 53, and it was a runner-up for the 2018 Press 53 Award in Short Fiction. Julie is a native of Connecticut, but she now lives in Israel, where she joins me from this morning. Julie, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Oh, thanks for coming on. I loved this book for a lot of reasons, and we'll get into what those reasons are. But I thought maybe we just start with you setting the stage for these 13 stories about Jeremiah Gerstler and his family and, you know, kind of talk about how he came into existence and how the collection sort of came together.
Sure. So I started writing this, the first a story. I mean, there's 13 stories, but taken together, they form a novel. And the first story that I wrote ends up being the last story in the book, and it's called Mixmaster. It takes place when Jeremiah is 82 years old, and he takes up a new hobby. So the way this story came into being, I was in a writing class, and I was still at the pretty beginning of my writing, like my creative writing life, about maybe a year and a half in, 2 years in. And I love writing prompts. I do really well with prompts. And I was in this class, and I said to the teacher, like, okay, can I have a prompt? And he's like, I don't really believe in prompts. I'm like, please. And eventually he relented and gave an optional prompt over the course of this class we were taking with him. And the prompt was, write a story about somebody who's definitely not you, but who does something that you're interested in or curious about. You might not know a lot about it, but you'd like to learn. It could be a hobby, a career, anything like that. So I wrote this story about Jeremiah, who is an 82-year-old man, so definitely not me. Over the course of the story, he takes up a new hobby, which is baking, which is something I like to do, but probably shouldn't. The problem is I like to eat what I bake, so
sure, yeah.
Not a great hobby, but my family likes it. And when I finished writing that story, I really was kind of enamored with this character, Jeremiah Gerstler, who I had created. He's a semi-retired professor in the story, and I wanted to unravel his life and kind of understand how he got to be the person he is at age 82. And I had also recently read Olive Kitteridge, and I loved that so much that I was, you know, kind of had that in mind as a model of writing a novel in stories, all focused around the same character. And with every story in Olive Kitteridge, I felt like a new layer of Olive was revealed, and I wanted to do the same so that I decided then, okay, I'm going to write a whole book about Jeremiah.
And so where did it progress from that? So your process in it began when he was 82. So it began at the end of his, you know, relative end of his life. And then where did you go from there in your own writing process? Did you bounce around through time or did you then kind of settle in chronologically?
Yeah, no, I bounced around completely. I think the second story I wrote was when he's a bit younger, like 72 or 73. It just ended up being a story called The Dutiful Daughter, which the first draft of that story had, like, and that story is told from Jeremiah's daughter's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
But the first draft of that story, she wasn't even in the story. but his age and the location of the story remain the same from the first draft till the end. And then I really bounced back further in time to the third story I wrote was in takes place in 1945, where he is a soldier in the U.S. Army, and he's in the war. It's July 1945. The war is over in Europe, but not yet in the Pacific. And he's on like a few days leave, and he goes to Paris, but he's about to be redeployed to the Pacific. So. After that, I don't remember the order, but those are the first three I wrote. But I just kept going back and forth in time.
So
when I was writing the story.
Yeah, it's so fun. I mean, I didn't fully do the math, but he was born sometime in the mid to late 1920s, I think. And
yeah, it goes
1926.
I know all my characters.
Yeah, I'm sure you know all these dates.
Yeah.
Yes. And then he lives at least until like 2006 or so.
Yeah.
And so it also really gives a wonderful backdrop to politics, history, world wars, presidential elections, all this stuff that's going on, like a retrospective of the 20th century. And, we can really feel the time periods and we can really feel how the U.S. and the world is sort of shifting under our feet through all these various time periods, which is so fun. I mean, that was an aspect that I don't think was quite as alive in the Olive stories. But that must have, it just gives another texture to the novel. And I assume it's something that you had a really good time playing with.
Oh, I loved it. I love history. And my mother is a former American history teacher. So I guess I inherited that from her. And I loved that, especially for the stories that took place before the modern, the contemporary age, and I had to do a lot of research. It just gave me this excuse to go down the research rabbit hole, mm-hmm. Like I might have spent like, so for that story that takes place in 1945 where he's a soldier, I made him a soldier in the Signal Corps, which is what my grandfather was in, and but I didn't really know too much about what soldiers in the Signal Corps were doing,
Uh-huh.
D-Day, and so I had to go out, go find, like, what were they doing? What kind of cables were they, laying down? What kind of equipment did they use? And so I might have, like, researched the other character in that story. So also, like, what the person was doing and during the Battle of the Bulge. So I might have, like, read these long articles or dispatches and, hours of research that might be great, but I love that stuff.
Yeah, so
it was really fun for me.
Super fun.
Research part.
And you said that you were influenced a little bit by Elizabeth Strout. This does have and we should sort of draw a distinction between interlinked short stories, interconnected short stories, which is also a really popular kind of genre of short story right now, and a novel and stories, because they really have a very different feel from each other.
Right.
And I know she sort of laid sort of a template for you, it sounds like. Were there others? I mean, the things they carried, I think Tim O'Brien kind of does that in that book as well. And as I was reading this, I was trying to think of other examples, but I don't know if there were other kind of pieces of inspiration that you were drawing from.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, A Visit from the Goon Squad also, you could say,
right.
Yeah. A novel and stories. Definitely a lot of, I looked at a little analysis on my spreadsheet of, like, how many stories were told from Olive's point of view and how many were from somebody else's point of view. That was for sure my model.
What did that reveal? How many were told from her? Do you remember? how she did hers?
There were 8 from Olive's point of view, and 5 from other people's point of view.
And this, it was really, I mean, I feel like it was very Jeremiah heavy, but I guess there were some, there was some Molly, there was a Molly story, and there was certainly a Hannah story. So yeah, you kind of did the same thing as well.
I guess I copied the number.
No, I mean,
I have one story. So I also had 8 and 5. So one story is told from his brother's point of view, one from his mother, his wife, his daughter, and his son.
Okay. Yeah.
So the only one who got like short shifted is, I guess, his father didn't get it, his own story. But
it does sort of feel like, you know, one of those old Polaroid photos that you take the Polaroid and then you just kind of wait for the picture to develop on the, that's sort of how it felt. And you know, the ordering of the collection is its own special treat because each of the stories obviously has to read independently, but they also have to work together, but it's not told chronologically either. You know, both you didn't write it chronologically and it is not told chronologically. So I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about deciding how to organize the collection when you needed to disseminate certain pieces of information. You know, and kind of letting it unravel, bouncing back through time.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a big challenge for me, how to structure it, because I knew I didn't want to go chronologically. My initial idea, by the way, because I wrote that first one when he's 82, was to go reverse chronologically. But then that also didn't work for a number of reasons. When I look back at my spreadsheet, I'm big into spreadsheets, I see that I had 6 different potential orders that I was considering. And what helped me really crack it is when I started thinking of the book in thirds, and I knew I had to kind of find a balance of the stories that were like young Jeremiah and older Jeremiah, and midlife Jeremiah, and the ones from other people's points of view. And the other thing that really helped me was there's an essay in a craft essay in a book by David Jouse. The book is called "Alone with All That Could Happen," and he has an essay in there called I have it right here. Keep it next to my desk. "Stacking Stones," I think "Stacking Stones: Building a Unified Story Collection." And he talks there about many different ways that you can build a collection. And what the thing that struck me was trying to find a common thread from the end of one story to the beginning of the next. So it could be, the common thread could be a phrase that's, you know, towards the end of the story and then repeats itself towards the beginning of the next. Or it could be a common theme. So, for example, I have one story told from Jeremiah's son's point of view. We understand in that story that they don't really have the easiest relationship. And then the story that follows that immediately afterwards, his wife is pregnant with the son. And at the end of that story, in that story, Jeremiah has just moved his young family from Washington, D.C. up to the Berkshires. He's kind of done a pivot in his career from government work into academia. But by the end of that story, he's feeling kind of unsure. You know, did he make the right move? Is he going to find a home for himself in the university? Will his colleagues accept him? And so that's where we land on that story, which takes place in 1964. And then the story that immediately follows that is 40 years in the future, and he's an emeritus professor, and we see, yeah, he has made it in that university, and it's been okay. So that is the common thread that helped me figure out the final structure.
Love this. So let's talk a little bit about those spreadsheets, because I'm always curious about how writers organize their material and how they structure things, because I'm a bear of small brain. I just, you know, keep short stories in my head, but keeping big novelistic structures in my head is really difficult. So I really love to kind of pry into this process. And so these are like Excel spreadsheets, or talk a little bit about what these look like, what material you put into them, and how you organize them.
The Excel spreadsheet, they're Excel spreadsheets, which is where I also keep like all my submissions to literary journals and all my thousands of rejections and occasional acceptances. Mm-hmm. And I have one worksheet in there that I've listed all of the stories, who, you know, who the main characters are, what are the themes, a few other, I'm trying to remember what else is in that, in the, you know, the themes.
Yeah, kind of sheet. Probably where you are politically and historically in time.
Yeah, the year, the ages of, you know, Jeremiah's age and maybe the age of the other characters. I have a few, I mean, I didn't think I'd put like any like fragments or the writing in the spreadsheets or ideas so much as it was more of a way for me to organize things once the story was written.
Yeah. And did you encounter any situations where you wrote yourself sort of into inconvenient corners, you know, that you had Jeremiah doing something in one story that you're like, oh, now this couldn't happen in this story, and a lot of then editing in the aftermath?
Not that I can recall. I have one story where Jeremiah's wife, or something surprising is revealed about Jeremiah's wife, and I don't want to give away any spoilers here.
Yeah.
But I had to, because she's a pretty stable person. She's kind of painted as like this, you know, the domestic core of the family and keeps him in line. He doesn't always behave very well, and she tries to keep him in line, make sure he does the right thing. But on occasion, she also snaps, and she, you know, she loses it, and like, who doesn't, right?
Right.
And in this story, it's revealed that she did something. She's kind of young and innocent, and I had to decide, you know, is this in character for her?
Yeah.
And I decided yes, and you know, then I had to go back and plant a few other examples of where, you know, where this might, you know, would help this thing make sense.
Yes.
But with Jeremiah, not so much. His wife is one that, and I did get feedback from somebody in one of my writing groups that, you know, I don't buy it.
But false. With
all feedback you get, you have to take it with a grain of salt and decide what you believe about your characters.
What I loved about all of these characters, and, you know, any great characters in literature and life, is that they're multifaceted and they have the capacity to surprise you, and they do that. I mean, over the course of 80 some years, who doesn't do some things that are a little surprising and out of, you know, what the expectations are? And so I think, you know, if you're too careful to paint a character as who they consistently are, it gets kind of boring. I just thought this was wonderful, really wonderful. My guest this morning is Julie Zuckerman. The book is The Book of Jeremiah, novel and stories. And you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I was wondering if we could take one of these, and you mentioned earlier in our chat today that there was a story in here, The Dutiful Daughter, that is told from the daughter's point of view, Hannah's point of view, and originally Hannah wasn't even in the story. So we could either do that one, or we could do one of the stories that may have given you a lot of angst and writerly hand-wringing, and kind of take it from the original kernel of what the idea was and kind of how the story evolved over time to become what, you know, what ultimately was published, and kind of walk through your writerly process, if that makes sense.
Sure. So we can take The Dutiful Daughter as an example.
Okay.
It takes place in 1999, and Jeremiah and his wife Molly and their adult daughter Hannah are on a trip to Israel. For me, like the setting and all the details of what they're seeing in Jerusalem and as they go through Israel, that was very easy because I see that stuff, you know, all the time. But in the original version, Jeremiah and Molly are on a trip to Israel, but Hannah's not with them. They have a nephew. Molly is into investing. There's like a whole high-tech element, like startup, because Israel likes to be known as a startup nation, and that's where, you know, my day job for the last 24 years have been working at high-tech startups. And so I was very attuned to that, and somehow I wanted to get that in to the story. And so, like, Molly wants to invest in some high-risk startup and through, like, the nephew's connections. And Jeremiah, who's a political scientist, all he wants to do is go meet with a colleague, a Palestinian colleague who's based in Ramallah. And so that part of the story, the Jeremiah wanting to go meet his colleague, that remained through into the final version. But the whole investment angle and the nephew, that all dropped. Although there is a line somewhere else in a different story that attributes that Molly has, like, taken up in an investment club. I don't even remember which story that's in. So that whole plot line ended up being, like, one line in some other story. But I don't remember at what point I decided to have Hannah join them on the trip. And the story ends up being much more about the relationship between Jeremiah and Molly and what he's willing to tell her and not tell her, and how he tries to co-opt Hannah into going along with this plan that he's concocted so that Molly won't worry about him. So, yeah, it was. I also had some trouble with the ending of that story, you know, with where I have Hannah. At one point, I had her having a more religious awakening, and I have her meeting somebody who's going to turn her more onto Judaism, because she's leading a very assimilated life back in the States. But then I think I ended up toning that down, and that other character that she met at one point also did not make it into the final version. But it's really about the relations between Hannah and Jeremiah and Molly and Hannah.
Yes, yes, yes. How many versions of that story did you, how many drafts were there?
It's hard to say. Probably major drafts, probably five, maybe six, and then lots of minor drafts and minor tweaks along the way.
I assume the titles must come towards the end. Well, especially in this one, because it wasn't about Hannah, and it's called The Dutiful Daughter.
Right.
So do you find, and a lot of the titles are found in lines in the story. So I was wondering if you write the story and then you kind of find the title buried within it.
So I'm looking at the table of contents now to remind myself of the stories. Yeah, a few of the stories, the title just came to me really quickly. Like, there's a story called Signals, which is the one when he's in the Army and he's in the Signal Corps, but also it's about all the mixed signals he's getting from the character.
Yeah.
I like doing double entendres or triple entendres,
yeah,
with my,
yeah,
with my story, with my titles.
Yeah. Mixed master,
another one
too.
That a
really
word
nice
that I made up, clandestiny. I don't think that's a real word, but.
But it's perfect. Yeah, but it's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, so good. Talk a little bit about Press 53, because I do want to highlight these smaller presses and the great work that they're doing and the great work they're putting out. How did you find them? What kinds of stuff do they publish? And, you know, kind of talk a little bit about working with a small press.
Sure. I never went through, you know, the query trenches because I had this story collection. My mentor, the same guy who didn't believe in prompts initially, but I think I can. He said to me when I felt I was ready and I wanted to get it out there and get it published, he said, "You know, it's going to be hard for you to find an agent, but there's a lot of small presses doing great things with story collections, and sometimes they run contests, so you should check them out." So that's what I started doing right away. Any small press that I heard of that published story collections, I would, like, buy a couple of their books and read them and see if I thought it was a fit. And some of them have open submissions periods, some through contests. So it's really sending it off to, I don't remember how many exact, 20 to 30,
oh, okay.
Different, you know, not all at once. And, of course, I started, you know, getting some rejection, some very nice and complimentary, but just wasn't a fit for them, or they were winding down their publishing. And then I entered this Press 53 contest. I think I first heard of them through, they have a literary magazine called Prime Number Magazine.
Hmm.
And I had submitted a story or two there, and then I had another, a different story I submitted there, not related to the collection, but that got accepted elsewhere, and so I withdrew it. And I got a nice note from Kevin Morgan Watson, who's the publisher of Press 53 and Prime Number, just pushing me, congratulations on, you know, on getting this story published. And so, you know, I asked him, I hadn't yet applied for the Press 53 award in short fiction, but I decided to do it then. And I had read, at that point, I'd read one other book by them, Glossolalia, which is also by David Joust, one whose craft book I mentioned before. And that was an excellent collection. So I knew I was, you know, it was a great publisher. And I guess in around April 2018, I got an email. Dear Julie, congratulations. You're the runner-up in the Press 53 2018 short fiction contest, and we'd like to publish your collection. What? You know? You're so used to getting rejections all the time. I think I had to read the email like four or five times before it sunk in. I also contacted a few other authors who had published with them. I heard, you know, great things about Kevin and the press. So they only publish story collections and poetry collections.
Okay.
They're based in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I think they've been around since 2005 or 2006.
Uh-huh.
So they've published quite a number of books since then. And it's just been such a pleasure working with Kevin and everybody there. You know, I had a lot of control over things like the cover, or if there was any, you know, extra editing I wanted to do, that was not an issue. And it's been a very positive experience working with them.
It does feel like when small presses fall in love with a book, they really fall in love with it and fall in love with the writers, as opposed to it being, you know, totally a business decision and a little bit more sterile process, you know, that they really go to bat. And that's...
Yeah. My first conversation with Kevin, the thing that I was most surprised at, again, because, like, you know, I've been putting these stories out there and getting racking up lots of rejection, he was just so complimentary about my writing. I was like, oh,
yeah.
Really nice to hear.
Well deserved. I mean, yeah.
Thank
the writing
you.
Is incredible. The writing is incredible. It's killing.
And the only thing about working with a small press is a lot of, you know, the marketing is all on you, you know, for the most part. Which I think probably even big press published authors also have to do a lot of their own marketing these days.
Yes, right.
But, you know, in my day job, I work in marketing, so it's not such a foreign thing for me to do. And you know, it just you have to figure out how to market yourself, which is
a little weird.
Harder.
Yeah, right. It's a little harder. Right, right. Oh, it's
yeah.
Killing me. We're drawing down on our time. Is there any last-minute advice, wisdom that we didn't cover that you've found helpful throughout the whole process? I love this craft.
The best advice I've ever gotten is from a fellow writer who had just had her first book accepted, and I was at the point where I thought, like, okay, I'm ready to, you know, get this book out there, but it wasn't happening yet, and I wasn't getting accepted by, like, top-tier journals, and she said, look, you're doing all the right things. Just keep honing your craft. That was her advice to me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that you live in Israel. There's all these online classes now. You can take, you know, and just keep, you know, keep working at it. And I did. did that, and I started taking some online classes, and then I met this whole community of other writers from around the world, and I'm still in touch. I'm in, like, now a virtual writing group with these women from all over the place. And so aside from the support, though, all these classes have continued to help me since I didn't, I don't have an MFA or anything like that. So that would be my number one
yeah,
advice.
Yeah, fantastic.
Is keep honing your craft.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say to any readers out there, what's really, really important for small press authors is if you like somebody's book, to please review it.
Yes,
like, right,
good point.
Short,
right.
Little review. It could be two sentences on Goodreads or Amazon or wherever you buy your books, because they really make a difference.
I love it. I love it. Julie Zuckerman, thanks so much for taking the time today. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Thank you. That was Julie Zuckerman. The book of Jeremiah is out and available now. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I am your host, Marie Stone, and again, we're doing what we do each and every Wednesday. We should chat with authors about their books. We are going to shift our focus from short story to science fiction. Anna Lee Newitz is an American journalist, editor, and author of fiction and nonfiction. They are a recipient of the Knight Science Journalism Fellowship from MIT and have written for Popular Science, The New Yorker, and The Washington Post. Anna Lee founded the science fiction website IO9 and served as editor-in-chief from 2008 to 2015, and subsequently was editor-in-chief at Gizmodo and the tech culture editor at Ars Technica. Anna Lee's book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction, was nominated for the LA Times Book Prize in Science. Their first novel, Autonomous, won a Lambda Literary Award. But it's Anna Lee's latest that we are going to chat about this morning. The Future of Another Timeline is published by Tor, a Tom Doherty Associates book. And it's going to be the drive our discussion this morning. Anna Lee, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So this is ambitious. There are a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of textures. It's sci-fi, and it's philosophy, and it's history and social justice. All that is to say, I'm going to not even attempt to do a better job than you will at introducing it for those who haven't yet had the chance to pick it up. So I'm going to let you kind of take us into the future of another timeline and set the stage for us.
Sure. So this is a novel about two women. One of them is a middle-aged academic who lives in a world where time travel has always existed. So time machines have been discovered in ancient crustal formations in a couple of different spots around the planet, and mostly these time machines are used by academics and some spies, but we don't really meet the spies. We mostly meet the nerdy academics, and they use them to go back in time and study history. They're not supposed to change anything, but my character, Tess, and her group of feminist researcher friends are actually going back and trying to change history to make things just a little bit nicer for women. And the other main character is a teenager named Beth, who lives in Irvine, and she is stuck in time. She definitely cannot move around in time, and she's pretty annoyed because she's trying to just survive high school and get off to college. And she's living in a situation where her family is abusive, and so she really wants to escape. And her best friend, Lizzie, who is usually her best way of escaping from her family, Lizzie has decided to, well, start murdering guys who are rapists. And they're part of the Riot Girl scene, so they've kind of absorbed an idea of feminism that's very rebellious and a little bit subversive, and so they've just decided that maybe they'll take justice into their own hands. And the one other thing I'll say about the story is that it's really about how Beth and Tess have a connection that we begin to understand as the novel goes on, and Tess starts appearing in Beth's life. Beth isn't sure why she's being visited by a time traveler. And that's kind of what propels the narrative forward, is trying to understand what brings these two women together living in this slightly alternate timeline.
Right, right. Tell me a little bit about the origin of the idea and sort of what sparked the idea, and maybe how the finished product differs from whatever you originally thought it was going to be when you set out to write it.
Sure, yeah. This is, as you said, it's a very complicated story, as time travel stories tend to be. There's a lot of moving parts. And initially, it started out as a novel that I imagined just being a straight alternate history. And I'd been thinking about this for a long time. I grew up in Irvine, and I really wanted to tell a story of teenagers in Southern California, a group of girls living in an alternate timeline where abortion never became legal in the United States. And for some reason, I kept thinking, well, if abortion were illegal, I mean, obviously it would make sense that teenage girls would just start murdering guys. And I'm not actually sure why that seemed to make a lot of sense to me, but that was kind of the seed of the idea was, teenage girls looking for justice, killing guys that they considered to be bad in this kind of desolate, alternate Southern California. And as soon as I really started thinking about the book and trying to figure out what would cause all of these things to happen, it seemed to me that time travel would have to be involved, because time travel would account for why the timeline was different, because there could be meddling from different political forces trying to alter the timeline to be more comfortable for people who didn't like the idea of abortion, or more comfortable for people who did. And it also just allowed me to do some weirder stuff with the characters. And of course, also the more I thought about it, the more I realized I needed to understand, you know, why these girls had become murderers, other than the fact that abortion was illegal, which was kind of a funny idea initially. But of course, once you're really in the trenches trying to tell a story about characters, you can't just rely on something gimmicky like that. You really have to explore the psychology of it.
Right. And so it was always going to be these two main characters, or tell me a little bit about discovering these two women.
It started out with the characters being just the teenage girls, so Beth's character, the young woman who's growing up in Irvine. And then as soon as I realized that there would have to be a time travel component, I created the character of Tess, who is our academic time traveler who teaches at UCLA. And her character came to me from, you know, a lot of the work that I've done as a science journalist. I talk to a lot of scientists, and I'm particularly interested in geology in the world of nonfiction. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that I wanted to have that character be a geologist. And so then I had to figure out, well, why the heck are geologists time travelers? And that was, of course, really fun, because then I invented the whole mechanism of time travel that I have in the book, where the time machines are kind of constructed within these crustal formations called shield formations on Earth. And so geologists are the ones who've kind of studied these crustal formations. And so time travel ends up being part of the geosciences just because time machines are found in rocks. And so all of that world building was really fun for me, just because I love writing about scientists and their kind of internecine battles within departments, and how those battles could somehow explode into something much bigger if they were time traveling.
I just want to walk around in your brain, because the architecture of your mind must just be baffling. I mean, each time I try to pull back a layer of the onion of this novel, I'm like, oh God, there's so much, as you say, there's so much world building to do for the reader that feels really seamless. And there's so much character development to do. And there's so many social justice issues to explore. And there's so many philosophical ideas to explore about manipulating time and time travel. And I'm like, what does your architecture look like in your brain? Because it's a lot to hold on to. So let's talk a little bit for people, who are interested in writing science fiction a little bit about that, kind of unpack some of these ideas about world building and how much, kind of how you go about it, because you have to do this in a way that doesn't feel super didactic to the reader and laborious about this is how this works. And these are, you know, I should say at the outset also that, I learned time travel is purely a literary device and is never going to be part, as you said, because you talk to a lot of physicists about this, never going to be part of our reality. So Too bad.
Yeah, too bad.
Too bad.
Well, luckily we can change the future. So in a sense, we can engage in some of the same activities that these time travelers do. We just have to change the present in order to change the future. We can't go back into history in order to change the present.
So, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, the world building part of this book, you know, it started out with, once I figured out I wanted to do a time travel story, I did spend a lot of time just figuring out the mechanic for time travel, which is something that's, it's fun to do as a writer, but I think it's also fun for the reader, especially with time travel or anything where you're doing something that's a really weird technology that could never exist. There's a certain pleasure in just learning about how it works. And so you have to figure out how to give your reader just enough of an info dump to get them excited about how time travel works, but not so much that, as you said, you're kind of bored and having like this long conversation about tachyons or whatever. So I started out by thinking about sort of the mechanic of time travel and building these time machines. And there's certainly a lot of that world building that wound up on the cutting room floor, where I have pages and pages of notes that never show up in the book, and lots of adventures that take place at the different time machines. The main time machine that my characters use is in Flin Flon in northern Canada, and which is a real city in northern Canada on the Canadian Shield. And so, you know, that's where most of the sort of time machine action takes place, along with one of the other time machine sites that I won't go into. But, you know, the other piece of it, which I think often gets forgotten in the excitement of building a weird technology, is character development. Mm-hmm. And I think characters are always part of world building, because a good character is someone who is responding to their environment and to their social environment, to their historical period, to the technologies available to them. And so I really feel like, as I was thinking about the technologies, I was also thinking about what would these characters' motivations be? How would they be thinking about time travel? For the character Tess, who actually does have access to a time machine, there's a whole language, a whole academic language around how time travel works, which anyone who's edited Wikipedia or even used Wikipedia will recognize, mm-hmm. which is they talk about editing the timeline and reverting edits, and having edit wars over different historical events. But then for a character like Beth, who's just a regular high school student who happens to be involved with murder, but mostly she's just a regular high school student, the question comes up of how would she think about time travel? Because she lives in a world where people are traveling through time in the same way that I grew up in a world where people traveled through space. And so the character of Beth and her friends are all really into a punk band that I invented called Grape Ape. And Grape Ape uses a lot of imagery of the time machine, and they have a slogan for one of their albums, which is, "They stole our time." Mm-hmm. And this is a metaphor for them about how colonialism works, but it's also just about time machines being cool and badass technologies, and what would it mean to steal time, and like, how cool does the time machine look? And I was thinking a lot about when I was growing up, and a lot of punk bands used imagery of the atomic bomb, and how that kind of functioned as a shorthand for massive destructive power and the horror of state power. And yet also it was just like, dude, it's so cool, it's a giant explosion. And right. So you kind of have to think about all that stuff as you're building this world.
I was having a conversation with an author a couple of weeks ago about what fiction can accomplish that nonfiction cannot, and that you can win people over to, not necessarily, I shouldn't say win people over to your side, but you can espouse particular social justice points of view through fiction and reach people otherwise perhaps non-sympathetic to your viewpoint in a way that you cannot with nonfiction. Because you've now plopped them, you know, they might pick up a fiction book. Nonfiction readers, I think, are going to self-select whatever they're going to read. Fiction readers, you can get a broad spectrum of people, and then you can you know, through empathy and character development, and as you say, you know, figuring out how these people are going to react to the environment they're in, really put the reader in the place of the character to make them much more sympathetic and their viewpoints much more sympathetic, if all that is making sense. And so I think, you know, fiction is just much more powerful in that way of being able to influence minds and influence maybe, you know, some social causes that nonfiction cannot do. And I was wondering in this case, you know, if that's some of the appeal for you of writing both fiction and nonfiction, because you're such a strong nonfiction writer, if all of that world building, character building allows you to do some things that you can't do in your nonfiction life.
It's definitely the case that's part of why I turned to writing fiction after having spent many, many years writing exclusively nonfiction about science. And for me, I think there is a lot to be said for the idea that fiction creates a kind of like a safe sandbox where we can try out different ideas, build different societies, and think about how they might work. And it feels, on one hand, it feels more personal because we wind up often identifying with the characters in the story, but it also feels removed from our everyday lives. It feels less personal. You don't feel attacked by a piece of fiction very often the way you might by a piece of nonfiction. If a piece of nonfiction is saying, you know, your ideas are wrong, here are better ideas, that can feel really alienating. Whereas in fiction, you can kind of tell a story about someone who has a different perspective, and it never feels like I'm necessarily challenging the reader's way of life. Particularly because it's a fantastical setting. It's a world that doesn't exist with technologies that could never exist. And so it's easy to say, well, this is just a fantasy. And when we go into that realm of fantasy, we really do let our guard down, and we are willing to entertain ideas that we might never entertain in real life. And so that's one of the reasons why I love exploring issues around feminism and social justice in my fiction, because I think it's just easier to talk about that stuff when people aren't feeling as defensive and as attacked, because social justice should be about everybody feeling better at the end of the day.
Right.
So
yeah.
That's what I would hope that fiction can kind of convey that feeling.
Yeah. You bring up a point that I hadn't even fully appreciated, which is that science fiction is yet another layer or a deeper level in which you can play, and maybe even more so than just a strict literary fiction novel can do. So I really like that idea that science fiction even gives you more latitude to create this complete fantasy world where people's maybe minds are even more open than they would be if they just picked up, you know, regular literary fiction piece.
Something
like
realistic. Yeah. No, and I think for me, that was why, because a lot of this novel, because it's about an edit war over history, specifically women's history and reproductive rights, I wanted a metaphor for what it means to have revisionist history and why we're always rewriting history. And there's nothing like time travel. Yeah. To have that kind of metaphor, you know, to explain, this is why we keep going back to history and telling new stories about it, because history affects how we understand ourselves in the present. It changes the way that we relate to each other in the present. And knowing what our ancestors were doing gives us a perspective on the future as well. And I think that's something that's very hard to explain in nonfiction, because especially right now, I think there's a lot of defensiveness about how there's this one version of history that we were taught that's all about the winners, and it's all about the presidents and the kings and mostly white men. And when women and people of color come in and say, like, well, actually, we have histories, too, and our histories also helped to build the nation that we know as the United States. When you say that in a nonfiction context, like I said, people feel like it's a contest over who gets to own history. And in my novel, what I tried to show is that it's not a contest. It's about how we all own history, and we tell different stories about history, and those stories give us strength. And it, you know, that's not, nobody has an exclusive right to control the past.
Right. God, I love it. So tell me a little bit about kind of how you kept all of this straight as writer. Did you outline this kind of before you sat down so you knew, you know, what the timelines and all of this was going to look like? Or did you kind of write it and then reverse outline it at the end? Tell me about keeping the information straight and kind of what your office looked like putting this together.
Yeah, I did not have a murder board, which I kind of regret because it would have been great to have all the pictures and yarn and everything like that.
Yeah.
But I did. I'm a big believer in outlining. For me, it really, really works. I know other people who prefer just to start and then, you know, figure it all out later. So I did have a loose outline of the book. I knew there's certain scenes in the novel that I knew I wanted to reach. And that I kind of had in my head the whole time. I knew how I wanted it to end. There's a mild twist ending, and I always knew that I wanted that to happen. And so there was a lot of, that's great to know because then I could throw little hints in here and there to make sure that a savvy reader looking back would say, oh, okay, yeah, no, she definitely paved the way for that twist.
Yeah.
And so I basically just had like a gigantic Google document that I could consult no matter what computer I was on to keep everything straight and keep the names of all the organizations straight and where all the time machines were and where everybody was.
Yeah,
and still, despite that, there are so many plot holes that I had to plug. And when I showed it to my editor and a bunch of beta readers, everyone kept saying like, but what about this? But how come this is happening? Like, if they have time travel, why can't they do this? And so there's a character that I added who's an insurance agent who goes back in time and working for an insurance company to save people's lives so that the insurance company doesn't have to pay out. And I added her purely because a friend of mine kept saying, like, you know, if we had time travel, it would destroy the insurance industry. And I was like, let me show you how it wouldn't.
Yeah, that was going to be my question. It would be so easy. Every time I was reading this, I was like, don't try this at home, folks. This feels like the novel that a new writer should not try at home. Because it would be really easy to have all these plot holes, as you say. And I think in science fiction, everybody's just waiting to jump down the writer's throat anyways. And also now I'm losing my own train of thought here, but ability to spin out and go in different directions that the novel never intended to go just because, you know, you want to follow the rabbit hole would also be very compelling and hard to resist. So I think it's, I think the outline for this would just almost be required. And even so, you had to rewrite it like four times, yeah?
Yeah, I did a lot of revision. My editor at Tor, Lindsay Hall, is fantastic at catching stuff like, this character just doesn't seem to be behaving the way we would expect, or here's a huge plot hole. And there were moments where I had kind of just gone off on like a weird tangent. And there's definitely like, there was a whole chapter about Lizzie's mom. Lizzie is best friend living in Irvine in the 1990s. And her mom, it's sort of hinted in the novel that her mom is a time traveler, but we never know for sure. Well, she is a time traveler, and I had a whole chapter about her traveling in time, and it was just, like, totally off the rails. Like, it didn't add anything. It was just kind of me wanting to know more about how cool Lizzie's mom was, and so that's not in there. But maybe I'll turn that into a short story at some point. But, yeah, it's definitely, and I had to do tons of research to make it all feel real too, there's a lot of that stuff. Like, even though I grew up in Irvine, I still had to go back and research a lot of the stuff that, that was in Irvine in the 80s and 90s that is not there now.
Right. So. Right. I mean, I should give a nod to Irvine since I'm sitting on the UCI campus and some of it takes place here. And I think it really is a wonderful setting because, I think it's a unique place for women to grow up. I raised a daughter here and I came here as an adult, but I think it's a uniquely weird place on the planet to be a woman, for a lot of reasons. And so I thought, you know, despite your growing up here, I just thought that was a really great choice of, you know, kind of conform, you know, it has such a today conformist, heavily Botoxed, whatever, character to it.
For sure.
So it was a good choice.
I mean, yeah, Jean Baudrillard wrote an essay about how, you know, Irvine is this kind of apotheosis of suburban conformity and sort of the simulated life. And when I read that when I was in grad school, I was like, oh,
yeah.
I grew up in a simulation. That's why I'm like this.
Yeah, right. No, right. Do you feel like this is a novel? Do you feel like you kind of had to have your background in science to tackle science fiction? Or do you feel like there's a base level of science required to enter this genre?
No, I don't think so at all. I think, you know, some science fiction is not really about science. Some of it is really about sort of future societies. I think if you're going to write about science, it helps to be fascinated by science and to know some scientists and to, you know, read about science. But I don't think, you know, you have to have a degree in science. I think it's really, ultimately, we should write about what obsesses us. And so if you're obsessed with, like, a future society of rock people who, you know, invent weird languages, like, you don't really need science for that. You just need to, like, really be into language and rock. and now I kind of want to read that book. but, you know, I think that, you know, science fiction is really quite a broad category. And I'm definitely on the side of being very inclusive about what counts as science fiction. I think there's other people who feel like we really need to police the edges of the genre and not let any fantasy come in and not let any literature come in. And I feel like, come on in.
Right.
You know, everybody should feel free to play with science fiction.
Love it. Oh, we're drawing down on our time. Any last minute words of writing advice? Research advice?
My main advice.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, my main writing advice is always to just keep writing. I think that one of the main things that makes us writers is that we get really neurotic about how much we're writing and how much we're being published. And I really think as long as you're writing, you're a writer. And don't worry about that part. Just worry about writing stuff that you really care about and really gets you excited. Don't try to write what the market tells you to write or, you know, what your mom tells you to write. You, of course, have to pay attention to the market eventually when you want to go get published. But to get through a novel-length project, you really have to be writing about something that you care about deeply. That's what's going to carry you through. So that's my main advice is just keep writing. You're a writer. Keep doing it.
You clearly followed your own advice because this was so fun. I mean, you could tell how much fun you were having when you were reading it, and that made it fun for the reader, too. So that, yeah, it really does shine through. If you're loving it and you're loving
well,
the process, it comes through to the reader, too, and makes it fun for everybody. So that's wonderful.
I think so, yeah.
Annalee Newitz, cool. This was wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. That was Annalee Newitz. The book, The Future of Another Timeline, is out and available now. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us and stay tuned for Orion's Belt coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.